Hello everyone. Hello everyone. It's a pleasure for me to present this work, joint work with Thomas Hyde Benjamin from Zurich Research Laboratories of IBM in Switzerland and Sergeant Kapkun. So I'll be talking about, as our program chair said, physical layer, so it's a little bit electrical engineering, and combine it with pattern matching and pattern recognition techniques, and all apply it in a security context. So my talk will start first with an overview of the problem that kind of motivated that work. Then I'll dig up in, I'll present the problem statement, and I'll go in deeper details, technical details, both from electrical point of view and pattern recognition, and present our experimental evaluations, and we'll discuss implications of that work in terms of security. I think that most of you probably already have that e-passports in the US. In Europe, the process is slightly slower, but it's getting there as well. E-passports contain purpose-built RFID chips to store information in it. And usually the contents is accessible via a wireless interface, which is complying with, there are two types of wireless interfaces standardized by ISO 14443, type A and IB. And the body that actually deals with the standards is the International Civil and Aviation Organization, ICAO. And actually what the chip here on the picture, on the picture you could see a typical antenna with a chip on a passport, actually quite well visible. And then inside the chip, we have what they call elementary files, EF, and each file defines a type of information inside. So we have information about the date of birth, also name and so on, the picture, and also space for fingerprint scans, iris scans, and also the last file is the COM file, which says what type of files are available in that electronic passport. So what has been research on security and proposed in the standard? We have basically three techniques. The first one is passive authentication. It's primarily for data integrity. It's required by the standard, so each passport needs to implement that. It stores hashes of the information and a public key, and the hashes are digitally signed with that private key. Of course, this supposes that there is a PKI infrastructure and all the equipment is connected to that infrastructure to do the checking. The second part is optional. It was introduced to actually against eavesdropping. So there is a very basic access control. The reader will derive a key for symmetric encryption based on the document number, date of birth, and date of expiry. And these actually fields can be found in the public part of the e-passport. And the last, actually more advanced feature is active authentication. It was proposed it's again optional, so it's almost not used at the moment in most passports. It's for cloning prevention, so there is a private key stored in a secured memory in the passport, and there is a challenge response protocol that actually verifies that that this is really the passport and not some clone that contains a different private key. Of course, after we started introducing e-passports, the community also starts hacking them. There's a number of works, this is just a couple of them that I selected for you. Cloning of e-passports was presented in Black Hat in 2006, so it was done by bit copy of all the content. There was a number of works as well, such as this one from Adam Laurie in UK, so he was able to break the basis access control by making an educated guess of the document number, so he was able to derive the key used for encryption and then be able to eavesdrop information on the passport. And then some other talks as well on different types of attacks on passive and active authentication. Then what we were following this process, and then we could see that people were trying to hack the passports and then review information, compromise privacy. And then we were thinking about, okay, can we identify or fingerprint an RFID chip? And if we can do it, what the accuracy would be? And actually, the motivation for that is that information can be easily copied, but hardware is probably very difficult to do. Or how difficult this is, an open research question. So we can move from, in my opinion, from human biometrics, like fingerprints, to also biometrics for hardware. So in this kind of investigation, we want to see if there is a hidden fingerprint in the in the chip, then we can use it as a biometric to identify that chip. And this can have a number of implications in terms of cloning detection, or as well privacy compromise, even though I'll show that this is probably not possible with our approach at the moment. So our current status is, thanks to my colleagues, we could make a hardware setup for signal acquisition from RFID passports. We have an implementation of a fingerprinting RFID reader, which is able to vary different parameters of the communications from the standard and derive features from them, and also some pattern recognition techniques for analyzing the data that we have collected. So what is our signal acquisition setup? It consists of a number of arbitrary waveform generators that are implement the standard, and also they're able to modify parameters in the standard. For example, we could modify the carrier frequency that we use to send a request to the passport. We could modify the baud rate. We could send arbitrary signals to the passport in order to test its behavior based on that signals. So here are part of the signal generators used. We had a fixed setup here, which was done by Tom in a very nice way. Okay, it's an experimental state at the moment. So it has it has two antennas. One is a transmitting antenna, which you use to send the stimulus to the tag. And there is an eavesdropping antenna here, which actually collects the information from the response of the passport. And here is the passport, which is put on top of the eavesdropping antenna, so that we have this kind of a sandwich style design. And then this gets digitized on the oscilloscope, and here the picture shows how a typical signal looks like. At the beginning is a stimulus, and then we have the response on the pure physical layer. So now the challenge became, how we find something unique in this signal. It looks pretty simple, right? You just send something and then we receive something, but analyzing that, it's probably quite hard. So we came up with a number of experiments in order to test different electrical properties of the chips. The first one is the pure standard specification. We send a standard stimulus wake up command, and then we collect the anti-collision response from the tag. Then the same experiment we could do by varying the carrier frequency, going really out of specification. So for example, if the specification specifies 13.56 megahertz plus minus 7 kilohertz of difference, we found out we can go down to 12.86 or 14.36 megahertz. So really a numbers of magnitude outside the specification and still be able to read properly the data from the tag. So we varied, so here for example on that picture, it shows that the tag, even on a very out of specification frequency, is able to answer, even though the answer is with a quite low signal to noise ratio. And then for the last three and four experiments, we actually tested the impulse response, the frequency impulse response of the antenna design, and also the charge capacitor of the tag. This is the first analog part of the circuit, by sending a sinusoidal burst of RF energy and see how the tag responds to that. And actually you could see here the picture, we have like kind of a nice shape of response of the RFID on the burst of RF energy sent to it. And on the other picture, we could see that it's the response of the tag based on a sinusoidal frequency sweep of RF energy. So we actually vary in a linear way the frequency from 10 kilohertz actually 100 kilohertz to 13.56 megahertz, and we record the frequency response of the tag on all these frequencies. And then we build up a nice database with all this data, and actually it's quite high dimensional data, lots of data points we collected. And okay, we had to do something with it. So we started looking at three different types of features that could potentially be used to fingerprint the tag, find something unique fingerprint inside. The first one was measuring the time between the reader query and the chip response. And actually, because these are passive devices, they use the clock of the reader. Depending on the variance of the carrier frequency, they will have different time delay between sending the stimulus and receiving the response. The second part was, if we go out the modulation-based chip features, the idea is that if we try to get the response of the tag on a really out-of-specification frequency, for example, 14.86 megahertz, the tag will have, especially the analog circuit, will have problems to correctly actually modulate that the response. And actually here on that picture, we could see how the tag modulates the response. It's an on-off keying modulation based on so it has a kind of interesting artifacts in the modulation once it's exposed to this kind of out-of-specification frequency. And the last but not least approach, which I will later show that it was the most effective, was based on extracting frequencies of the response of the tag based on this burst and sweep signals that we have sent and recorded the responses from the tag. So these are the three types of features that we considered in that work. How we tested our evaluation. It was quite hard to get e-passports, unfortunately, in Switzerland. So we had 10 passports, usually from colleagues in the university that have received these. And also we purchased 50 Java cards, which has NXP chips, And they're basically almost the same chips that are found in most of the European passports at the moment. And then we evaluated our features proposed in terms of classification. Are we able to distinguish between country of issuance or year of issuance, and also identification? Are we able to identify even same model and same manufacturer chip designs? And that's why we had this 50 identical purchased at the same time RFID cards. So in terms of classification accuracy, we had a small problem with three countries and then the 10 GCAP cards, that means like four classes. We found that timing features were actually quite consistent within all countries that we have in our set. So they were really with very low classification accuracy. We could not find consistent timing, different timings in the response. In the case of modulation features, it was much better. All the three countries and the GCAP cards had consistent different modulation shapes on auto-specification frequency. And here on this picture, I actually briefly showed them. You could visually see the difference of how the tag responses to auto-specification, outputs its response on auto-specification frequencies. And we had on these four classes 100% successful classification. Of course, the set is not that much. We need much more classes of countries in order to further validate that interesting fact. And then we went to the identification. So we had our 50 identical and same model, same manufacturer, same specification RFID chips. And then we used our spectral features, this frequency information that we extracted from the frequency impulse responses of the tag circuitry and the antenna design. And then the results were really interesting. For the burst and the sweep features independently, we had an accuracy of 5% equal error rate. This means that if we allow a 5% of false accepts, then we have a 95% of successful identification, which we also call genuine accept rate. Here on these graphs, I just show that this performance varies based on how many responses from the tact you have used in order to derive your fingerprint. So if you derive your fingerprint from 5 signals collected from the tag, then the accuracy is much worse. It goes around 13% equal error rate. But if we use 15 signals, so we average our fingerprint over these 15 collected signals, then we have as low as 5% for the burst features and as low as 4.5% on the sweep features. And actually the features are stable because all these experiments were done by putting the tag and the passport, removing it, putting it back in order to see if subsequent positioning doesn't change the extracted fingerprint. So it proved to be stable on repositioning of the tag on the platform. And then, okay, we said we have this 5%. What will happen if we combine both burst and sweep features? And actually it turned out that this is something that we didn't explore furthermore yet, but both fingerprints from the sweep and the burst here on the graph are probably independent. We cannot attest that with full accuracy, but if we combine them, like the red is the sweep and the blue is the burst rock curve, the receiver operating characteristic, and if we combine them, the accuracy actually improves dramatically. So if we allow, for example, a false accept rate of 1%, then we reach, combining both features, 90% of successful identification. If, okay, we further go towards higher false accept rates, like 5%, then we go to 100% successful identification. Of course, what is important, I think, in future is that we should improve all as well that part of the curve so that for really low false accepts, we also have a high successful identification rates. So how can we use actually fingerprints on e-passports? Here we present an application on e-cloning, cloning detection. So the one scenario would be that we could store these fingerprints in a backend database. They're actually very small. It's around 120 bytes. And then we can do online verification. Another approach would be, given that we have enough space in the e-passport elementary files, we could store that fingerprint as well in directly digitally signed in the document itself, and then verify the fingerprint of the RFID offline. Conclusion and future work. So our investigation showed that RFID transponders, especially in the high frequency HF that is used for e-passports, can be uniquely identified. There is with quite good accuracy due to manufacturing variability, even in same manufacturer and same model chips. However, now we are currently investigating, can we improve that identification accuracy? Because, for example, in terms of cloning detection, we would like to have an even better, going down to 0.1% of equal error rate, or trying to match to be as accurate as possible. There is a number of interesting issues that we are actually currently exploring. Is it possible, how hard is to reproduce the fingerprint that we have extracted? And we have a technical report that in some cases, if you use a very sophisticated, high-end arbitrary waveform generator, you might be able to accurately replay that signal. But this is very preliminary works, and there's a number of assumptions that need to be addressed in it. And then, of course, explore additional attacks and countermeasures against that kind of a physical, let's say, biometric fingerprint of the RFID tag. So with that, I conclude the talk, and if you have any questions and answers, I'll be very happy to answer them.
Very interesting discussion. Was there any testing done based on environmental impacts to the signal that comes back, such as temperature, EMF in the room, or age of the device? If it's been sitting in storage for 6 months, does it still produce the very same signature as it did previously?
Yeah, very interesting question. We have not done yet the results, but we are currently collecting the after 6 months of work fingerprints from the same carts, and we will very soon have the results on that if aging of the carts has an effect. In terms of environmental noise, this was all done in laboratory environment. There is no with kind of a normal conditions, normal temperature under air conditioning. We didn't investigate really different high variability in terms of temperature in the environment, which I, in my opinion, would have an effect. If you go, for example, from 10 degrees to 30 degrees, this would definitely have an effect on the components of the tag. So in a practical setting, it's important to actually control these parameters, in my opinion.
Thank you.
Yes? Actually, a comment and a question. You said that the use of this information, you could use it to identify clones and store the information on the tag. I thought the obvious usage of this would be for attack purposes, where you could, for instance, differentiate between carriers, passports of different countries without having any of the credentials. So somebody could build a rogue reader and identify Dutch from American passport holders from a distance. That was a comment. I don't know, you maybe have thought of it. The other question I wanted to ask is, has the idea of physical protection of the passports been implemented? Do they shield the passport cover with a Faraday cage so that the passport cannot be read when it's closed?
Okay, from our experience, we had a number of passports. I would say that, for example, the American passport has some kind of a shielding that we could measure in some sense. Other passports, like British passport, for example, which is the one on that picture here, the tag and the antenna were directly visible in the passport itself. So different countries apply different types of. In the U.S. passport, you cannot see anything, and even if you probably you need if you do any kind of infrared, you would be able to see inside the structure. But in other passports, it was directly visible. So I think, I'm not sure in the standard if it specifies any type of shielding that is required or something. Yeah. And on the other first question about the privacy, in terms of probably it's quite not very difficult to do that over a distance for different countries. But according to our experience with the features that you identify uniquely each different tag, we couldn't do that over a distance because the features were changing due to antenna polarization and the capturing effects. So that's why we cannot claim a privacy violation from that point of view.
Question at the back.
I was actually also interested in the privacy implications. I think, and if you have anything more you can say about that, I'd be interested in hearing it, or otherwise I think maybe the question's already been answered.
Sorry, can you repeat your question?
I was also interested in the attack on anonymity for privacy applications.
From a
but
distance.
It sounds like you've already answered that pretty much.
Yeah.
So. Unless there's anything more that you could say, but it sounds like you've already addressed that.
Yeah.
So, thank you.
Thanks.
Do you have any thoughts on how well this might work with UHF tags?
That's an interesting question, and actually we are currently doing investigation on that. The protocols are slightly different. They use different modulation schemes, and it might not work this type of when you send this kind of a sinusoidal RF energy to the tags, because they usually have a distance of 1 meter, for example, between the EPC tags, this ultra high frequency. So this might not be a very good idea to do. But our preliminary investigation shows that they used also some kind of a BPSK modulation and also amplitude modulation. So there will be interesting properties to measure in that sense, in my opinion. Yeah.
Okay.
I was actually going to ask the same thing, but I had a follow-up, and that was, do you see any correlation, or do you expect there's any correlation with the cost of the device and the accuracy of this technique? Would the cheaper tags have more variability, or do you see no relationship?
Yes, definitely. I think that I was discussing this with a number of people, and actually people who did this 20 years ago as well, and they said that it was much more difficult to find variability 20 years ago than now. Due to
because they were higher quality or lower quality?
It seemed to be that the analog circuits were kind of not with high, in a sense, they were built with more care and not in an automatic way during that time. And now it's also there are previous works on wireless transceivers. You can identify also identical chipcon radios from sensor networks as well, and they seem to have enough variability to do that. So. I mean, in my opinion, the cheaper the design is, more variability you have, definitely.
Thanks.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.